Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Science Studio program. Keith Pannell here with this co-host this week, Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is another material scientist. He's a material scientist that comes, in a sense, from engineering. And his particular passion, his particular interest at the moment is carbon. Now, most of you out there know about carbon as diamonds or graphite. Maybe you've heard of buckyballs, you know, this C60, these spheres that are apparently 90% of what's out there in space. But there's another form. There's a form called graphene. And we're going to be talking about graphene and its particular uses. And so today our guest is Matteo Pasquale. He's an engineer from Rice. He also happens to be the chair of chemistry. Matteo, welcome.
Keith, thanks a lot for having me on the show. I'm very pleased to be here.
Why don't you tell us in the audience how you began? That's where we like to start these programs. What was young Matteo thinking when he was 7, 8, 10, whatever?
Well, young Matteo had a very happy experience growing up in Italy because back in that time and even now, the Italian educational system didn't really force you to choose until very late. And you could do all sorts of things, you didn't have to go get the best grades to go into the best schools, etc. So I always liked math and science, and I was pretty good at it. My parents were both educators. My dad was a professor of chemical engineering. My mom was a school teacher. So in high school, I really liked chemistry, math, and philosophy. And as I was finishing up high school, I realized that it's really, really hard to make a living with philosophy unless you become somebody like Umberto Eco, who passed away just recently. And I kind of had the impression that a lot of professional mathematicians become a little odd, to say the least.
And, so you would ascribe to the fact that studying math makes them odd, as opposed to being odd makes them study math?
Somehow I didn't establish causality, but I saw the correlation, and I thought that was enough for me.
What place in Italy did you bring up?
I grew up in Bologna. And so I thought, okay, chemistry, but I also know that in engineering you typically do more math. Also with my dad being a chemical engineer, I decided to go into chemical engineering so I could study chemistry and also study mathematics. And I thought, you know, four jobs is going to be a good prospect.
And so you were really driven, in a sense, by later employment.
Yeah, I would say that would be pretty typical in Italy because the liberal education for us is really high school. So in high school, we take a lot of philosophy, a lot of humanities, and we're a little bit older when we graduate. We're typically 19. It's a little longer educational system. And so, people usually look at university not so much as a way to grow, but as a way to start on a professional path.
Did you do any experiments in your backyard when you were younger?
Not that I recall. My dad brought home phenolphthalein to do the pH changing and show the water changing color. That I remember being impressed when I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And I did go to my dad's lab now and then, especially during the summer. They would give me something that was not hazardous and I could play around and mix things. And I remember making something that would evaporate and make a lot of smoke, but I actually don't remember what I was doing.
Well, tell me, what did your father do? What chemical engineer, but did he have a particular focus?
He was one of the early people that got into computers, computer modeling. So back in the 70s, I actually do remember playing with punch cards. So these were the discarded pieces of his programs, and he would do modeling of chemical processes, and later on he got into bioremediation. He did more government consulting than actual research later in his life. At some point he decided that he had a family and research wasn't paying very well in Italy, and so doing government consulting was a better way to help all of us go forward, especially after my mother died.
Would that be analogous to sort of having contracts for particular projects like you can with DOD as opposed to research grants, which are more, you write your own proposal?
Yeah, it would be more like, for example, environmental impact assessments or you know, study of a bioremediation of a specific site consulting on the planning stages, say, of a waste disposal facility and what could be the impact of those things. So more practical engineering than actual research.
No, I was just interested in bioremediation because I worked on that from Exxon quite a bit. Was it successful? Did he have any good cleanups?
I think so. He actually got involved also. I remember when I was growing up, at some point we had a problem with algae on the Adriatic Sea, so on the east coast of Italy. There's a lot of nitrogen that gets discharged into the upper Adriatic, a couple of hundred kilometers south of Venice. And that's coming from mostly the pig farms.
The nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer, yes, I'm very familiar with that.
And so he got involved in that, and it was a period, I was in high school, I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention, so all I know that later on they got it under control, but I don't know how much was my dad's success versus other things.
Okay, so you went through a really liberal high school education, and then you went to university in Bologna.
Yes.
And then I know that you landed up in North America for graduate studies. Tell us that decision process.
Well, so I in Italy it was a 5-year degree where you had to write a real dissertation that typically would result in a scientific paper, so I did my research with Professor Santarelli, who is on the faculty until actually last year. He just retired. And Professor Santarelli had a collaboration with Professor Paul O'Keefe at University of Bath in the UK. And so I actually spent some time in the UK and got exposed to a different environment with a lot more PhD students, a lot more research intensive. And I really liked it. And it looked like I was pretty good at it again. And so I thought, okay, I want to go to a place where there's the best research is being done. And I asked for advice to a number of people in Italy, including Professor Astarita, who had a half-time appointment at University of Delaware and half-time appointment in Naples in Italy. And he said, go to University of Minnesota. And, you know, later on I realized that this was really the dominant place in chemical engineering up to the 90s. And so I decided to apply, and they took me, and I went.
And what did you study for your doctoral thesis in the U.S.?
So what I really wanted to do was theory applied to the physical chemistry of polymers, polymer solutions, maybe the chemical physics of polymers. And I wanted to work with Matt Turrell, and Matt had changed areas. And, of course, at that time, you know, it wasn't like now that you could look up on the internet papers immediately. This is 92, 93. And so he basically had finished up that area a couple of years before, and he was into more biomedical work, which I didn't find a whole lot interesting. And so I worked with Skip Scriven, who was doing related work on complex fluids, and I worked on modeling how polymer solutions flow when they make very thin films. This is a process that's very important for coating. At that time, it was very important for photographic film, photographic paper. Of course, now that whole area is
gone. How quickly things change.
But it turns out it's actually, you know, very pervasive, and it's even like it's even important, you know, making displays. So eventually, a lot of those people working in that area retooled themselves, and they're working still in imaging, but in different ways.
Okay, thin films. Graphene, it's a form of carbon. Thin layers of graphite. Tell the audience, really, what is graphene and what is your interest in it? Because that's the key area of research at the moment, all over the world, in fact.
So graphene is a single layer of carbon atom, and these carbon atoms are arranged in a way that each atom is connected to three other atoms. What that means is that each one of these carbon atoms is actually able to share one of their electrons with their neighbors. And this gives a very interesting electronic properties to this material. So that you can conduct electricity very fast. And if you make some modifications, you can get actually high electrical conductivity. Or you can make this into a semiconductor, and so you can use it for electronics. And at this level of a single layer, even though graphite is black, once you make it thin enough, it becomes essentially almost transparent, and so it has also these advantages. There's other advantages. For example, you can make materials that have very high surface area. So if you stack this graphite together without having the layers exactly collapse on top of each other, you can build a lot of interstitial spaces where other materials can go and absorb.
Now, if you take a single layer of graphene, has anybody actually measured the conductivity? I mean, I keep hearing rumors that if a single infinite sheet really conducts electricity very rapidly.
Yes, the mobility of the carriers is really high. What happens is there's no carriers in what's called the conduction band. And so to have conductivity, it's a little bit like, to move things fast, you have to have a highway, yeah. A really nice highway, but you got to also have cars. And in graphene, it's like a beautiful highway, but there's very few cars. And so somehow,
so these are the electrons in the conduction bands are missing.
Right. And so you have to have ways to inject carriers in there if you want to make it conductive.
So now, what are these carriers? What are these cars? Do you collaborate with your colleague Jim Tour, who makes these wonderful little motor cars out of buckyballs and goodness knows what else?
No. These are the cars. Is just a metaphor here. It's not to be intended as an actual car or an actual highway. These are actually material. You would put in other elements. For example, you could put in chlorine, bromine, and elements that are electron rich and have a propensity to donate electrons, and that's how you can make this highly conductive.
But the cars are the electrons, correct? In the conduction band.
Yes, but you can also make it a whole carrier. So you can also deplete, and then you can make graphene to be a whole carrier.
Now, I was reading that there were 7,000 patents on graphene a few years ago. This was in the Wall Street Journal, but it was too expensive. Is it still too expensive?
It depends. Graphene, we're talking to it as a molecule, but it isn't a molecule. For example, a moment ago you said, well, if I had an infinite sheet of graphene, then I would have certain things. One way to get graphene is just take graphite and spread out the layers.
Well, but you peel it with Scotch tape. That's a little expensive, no?
Oh, chemists, that's the way the physicists were doing it. The chemists have other ways to do it that are a lot more effective.
And we'll come back and discover the way that Matteo Pasquale does it in a minute. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, and as I said, Professor Matteo Pasquale from Rice University, an expert on graphene, another form of carbon. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Matteo Pasquale from Rice University. And Matteo was just beginning to tell us that, there's crude ways of making thin films of graphene. Physicists do that. And then there's sophisticated methods that chemists use. So as chemists, how do you make thin films of graphene? And what do you do with the films once you've got them?
Well, so I actually don't do very much of this, Keith.
Well, let's do another program, shall we?
some of the methods, but at some point, chemical vapor deposition, for example.
At some point, I'll tell you, I will roll them up, make carbon nanotubes, and then we'll be good to go. But the way you do it is a variation on an old method to exfoliate graphite. Essentially, there are certain types of acid that spontaneously intercalate into graphite, and so the molecules of the acid go into the layers and expand it. And so there's modifications of these methods have been developed in the last decade that allow you to take bulk quantity of graphite and then using essentially pot chemistry, get a highly exfoliated material. And then once you have it in this highly exfoliated form, you can stabilize it in liquid as a colloid, and essentially you can make paint or something that looks like paint, and then you can deposit by lots of coating methods the way you could put down an ink, say. And what happens in these cases is that these two steps, these three steps really, you know, when you start with the initial graphite, it's not like you have infinite layers of perfect graphene composing your graphite. There's some graphite that's more highly perfect and crystalline, and some is less. Then when you do this first step of exfoliation with the acid, typically you introduce some further defects, and in some cases the colloidal stabilization can also give you some more defects, and so you end up with a material that is yes available in more bulk quantities, and you can then treat as an ink, and however is not actually the same as the graphene that we'll look at is in a picture of a computer model.
So what do you do with these now new sort of materials? What's your real interest? What's your goal?
Well, my real interest is actually to take parallel form of graphene, which is what happens when you have graphene with this layer. You have it rolled up in a little cylinder, and that's called a carbon nanotube. That can actually be synthesized very effectively by gas phase chemistry, catalytic chemistry, which is not that different from the way we make polymers. And it has some major advantages with respect to graphene. Some of the nanotubes actually do have a high density of carriers, not only the mobility. So some of them not only have good highways, but they are actually highways that are populated by cars and trucks. My interest is to make, starting from these molecules, to make macroscopic materials that are highly conductive, but they're also soft, or at least I can tune the stiffness of these materials. It turns out that in nature, you don't really have materials that have both of these properties. If you think about highly conductive materials, for example, metals, or for thermal conductivity, diamond, these are materials that are very stiff. And one reason is because crystallinity helps conductivity. It's not the only component of conductivity, but it is something that helps conductivity. But it turns out that if you use long, slender rods, you can actually assemble them on larger scale and control a little bit of disorder in the assembly, and you can get softness. For example, we can make fibers of carbon nanotubes that are very highly conductive. We're talking about more conductive than steel, getting about 20% of the conductivity of copper right now. But they handle like a thread, the same thread that you would use to put on a button on a shirt.
Well, so we can run. Can you actually make sweaters?
We're sewing them with a sewing machine. On clothing, yes, we sell them on T-shirts, and also they're very resilient. We can throw them in washing machines, and the conductivity doesn't go away; it's retained. And so, you know, you can think about lots of interesting things. For example, if you think about our bodies, all the high-speed communication in our body is electrical signal. There is a secondary pathway that's chemical, and that's much slower. And but, you know, all the brain, the heart, the central nervous system, they're all communicating with by electrical signals. We don't have a way to restore a broken pathway right now. So when we have a mechanical failure, like if we break a tendon, we can take the two ends of a tendon and we can suture them together, and mechanically we can restore function. We cannot do that with a nerve. All we can do is bring the two ends of a nerve close to each other and put something that holds them there and hope that they regrow into each other. And the same is true for the heart. Once the heart starts losing conductivity, there's no way we can restore that conductivity. All we can do is manage with what's called ablation. We can selectively remove the conductivity in various areas to even the conduction on the heart. But now, with this new material, we can actually do these functions. And because it's so soft and matches very well the properties of the tissue, we can actually have long-term implantation without material failure and without scarring.
So is this experiment, I mean, you must be collaborating with medical facilities all over the place. Have people actually taken two nerve endings that have been ruptured, connected them with some threads of this type, and found them to be useful?
We've done this. We're doing some of these experiments. We've done it in collaboration with Baylor College of Medicine for the nerves. We've done brain sensing. So we use them on as electrodes to stimulate and detect brain activity in rodents and mice. And that's done with some collaborators at Rice, who are Caleb Kamer is in neuroscience. And for the heart work, we work with the Texas Heart Institute, which is also in Houston, and Mehdi Razavi. So these, of course, are all early-stage studies on tissues, tissue culture, and in some cases animals, but we see a lot of promise.
So you're actually working in this connection between medicine and the conductivity? That's one of your areas?
This is an area where I evolved. Initially, we didn't set out to make these materials. We were trying to make materials mostly for the aerospace industry.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make materials that were lightweight and conductive.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, these materials are also lightweight. Again, compared to metals, the density is a factor of 5 to a factor of 10 lower, depending on which metal you compare. But this is what happens when you're in the lab. Sometimes you find out that there's the what you made behaves in a way that you hadn't really expected.
Good for something else.
And then you can think, okay, it's good for something else. And it's also, we started working on wearable technologies because, as you said, we could make conductive sweater. Right now, we don't have enough material. We can't make enough material to make a full sweater, but we can make patterns on sweaters.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, when you think about new materials, and especially nanomaterials, a small amount can do an awful lot of – a lot of experiments can be done on a small amount of material. What are the bulk amounts of material that you can, in fact, make in terms of your thread, for example?
So the way we make the material, we actually buy the nanotube powder from a supplier, and then we develop the whole solution processing method. So in terms of availability of the source material, some suppliers now are at the level of many tens of kilograms per year. So many tens of pounds, and there is one supplier now that's a level of 5 ton per year, and this is very high quality material. But these are commercial enterprises now. Of course, in the lab, we can't set up machines that match that kind of capacity, and so we typically can make samples that are in the gram level.
Well, I think it would be interesting to predict some of the uses for these things. I was reading an article the other day that said people will wear shirts that light up at night with your friend's name on it and get charged during the day.
Yes, I think this would be possible. I mean, and really one of the things that we're thinking about is wearable computers. It's
Wearable computer, yeah.
Yeah, so you really need a material that matches the mechanical property of textiles, which is really the softness. And also, you probably will want to wash this computer now and then.
It sounds science fiction, but of course it's real. With these sorts of new materials, and especially with the entertaining properties, you must have lots of students clamoring to sort of get into this new area. And a lot of them thinking startup companies down the road also. Talk about that a little bit, the interplay between you and an academic institute and some of the aspects of commercialization.
Yeah, this is a very good point. And this is something that, of course, it's been going on for a while, but universities are paying more and more attention systematically.
And Rice is way ahead on that.
Rice is one of the leading institutions. And so... Yes, I'm fortunate that Rice attracts lots of very bright students and postdocs, and there's always quite a few of them who are interested in joining our lab, etc. In recent times, definitely, there has been a very strong interest from my students and postdocs in starting companies. And so in the last 2.5-3 years, three of my students and one of my postdocs started two companies, two pairs of them started two companies. One is more focused on the medical technology, it's called Nanolinea, and one is more focused on the wearable technology and also aerospace industry, and it's called Dexmet.
When there's a startup company like that, and I'm familiar with them too because we do that too, you have a scientist, an engineer, and a business student?
We have not had the business person students. So the scientists and engineers that now have access to classes and mentors who come from a business world so that they actually can do some of the commercial portion themselves. And the NSF actually is really pushing this. There is a program called iCorps, and it stands for Innovation Corps. And Rice is one of Texas institutions that has a Southwestern node. And, you know, basically they set up programs where the PhD students can learn enough about business to put together plans.
I was going to say, is that beginning to percolate down to the undergraduate curriculum a little?
Absolutely. It is percolating into the undergraduate curriculum. The undergrads have an innovation center. They have makerspace where they can go and try to make things, prototypes, etc. What I would say, though, is the chemists are a little bit of a disadvantage in this area, because it's a lot easier if you're making a mechanical device or an electronic device. You don't have nearly the same type of hurdles in terms of specialization of what you're doing and regulation of what you're doing compared if you do chemistry, where, of course, safety is a much bigger concern, environmental impacts are much bigger concerns. And, of course, the ones who have it easiest, frankly, are the guys who are doing software.
So Matteo Pasquale, Rice University, engineer, chair of chemistry, entrepreneur. You have your own companies, presumably.
So I co-founded the companies with the students, and the idea is that they're going to be the executives, and they're going to partner up with business people to take them out, and I'm just watching them.
Thanks for being here, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we will be back next week with another Science Studio, so don't go too far from your radio. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks, Cross. And thanks, Norma.